Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again. It's a Tuesday afternoon, and we are live today talking about the Torah Teachers Roundtable and some of the things that don't get as much press, don't get covered, because they're not part of the regular annual Torah cycle or you go to a lot of Sunday churches, of course, and as far as they're concerned, the Old Testament doesn't even exist. It's all done away with anyway, so they don't talk about that. So these are histories and things that are a lot more important than most of us have grown up believing. Anyway, we're talking now about the book of 1 Kings, and in fact, for the most part, probably one of the more famous stories in this book, anyway. And it's the story of a pretty nasty woman, and we see the prototype here, but she certainly roams the streets of America in spirit in a whole lot of ways, Jezebel, and what she does with a vineyard and so forth. So we're going to talk about 1 Kings chapter 21 today. And, MP, good afternoon. We'll say hi to Rob, too. Rob, let's go to you first. How are things where it's still dark on the opposite side of the world?
Well, it's hot in the middle of the night, still hot.
That doesn't surprise me a lot. Yeah, okay.
Well, we only have three seasons. Hot, hotter, and hot as hell.
Okay, yeah.
That's the seasons we have in Thailand. Seriously, there is a winter for about 2 weeks that the thermometer dips down in the low 80s, high 70s. That's only for about 2 weeks. It seems cold when you're climatized to this heat. But anyways, right. The heat is coming back around. That means the rainy season is upon us, which is an interesting thing.
Especially riding a motorcycle. It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Yes. Well, because we do ride motorcycles quite a bit because it's a little bit too expensive to purchase a vehicle, a car, I mean, or a truck. Anyway, so we get around with motorcycles. But anyways, the heat and the rain are an interesting mixture. We used to say it was steamy back home. No. We didn't know what steamy was.
You haven't seen steamy.
I've literally seen the steam while it rained.
Okay. You know, I'm almost sorry I asked. But yeah, it's nasty. We're looking forward to not steamy, but springtime anyway, Rob.
Yes. Well, spring has sprung and summer has invaded. I don't know. It just goes right into summer.
Well, cool. I guess.
So I think.
Or not so cool.
Yeah. This week Songkran Festival starts, which is the Thai New Year. Well, it used to be Thai New Year. Now Thailand has come over to the secular New Year of the world, but they still celebrate the ancient New Year of Thailand, which is the Songkran Festival. And I didn't know about this last year, and we're going down the road, and all of a sudden people throw water on you. And,
oh, yeah.
A lot of water.
You actually told
us about this last
week.
Yeah.
So you still got it.
That's coming up, yes, this week, I guess. Uh-huh.
Okay, well,
so
hopefully you'll stay dry, or at least relatively dry.
Yeah. Anyway, looking forward to today's story about the murder of Nebat.
Yeah, let's do that. All right, MP, howdy, and you want to... You want to kick us off and start reading some of that?
Sure, I'd love to. How about I read the first four verses and then comment on them and let you guys have it? Okay? Here we go. And it says, this is, and I'm reading KJV, of course, "And it came to pass after these things, Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard, which in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, Give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it's near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it. If it seem good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money. And Naboth said to Ahab...
In silver, actually, yes.
He said, Jehovah forbid it that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. And Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth, the Jezreelite, had spoken to him. For he had said, I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid down him on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. Boy, he was despondent, wasn't he? Well, we're not told how long after Micaiah brought Jehovah's judgment to Ahab that this incident took place, but I think it was almost as soon as the king returned to his palace adjacent to Yisrael, which is how that is pronounced in Hebrew, Jezreel, okay, Yisrael, not to be confused with Yisrael, okay. Naboth is from the Hebrew Nov, which means to flow forth or to flourish. Now, Naboth looks like to abundantly flourish, being a plural of Nov. So Azamra's note at the beginning of this chapter is really good. What they say is this. The sorry story of the murderous appropriation of Naboth's vineyard by King Ahab put the final seal on his fate and that of his dynasty. Many people permit themselves to believe in what they please while claiming themselves to be quite as moral, if not more so, than those who seek to uphold the law of God's Torah. Ahab first allowed himself to go after the gods of the other nations. Now we see how his willingness to violate what may seem to be the least serious of all of the Ten Commandments, coveting the property of others in Exodus 20 and verse 14, drew him into a spiral of sin that led him to violate at least half of them. Verse 1 says that Naboth's vineyard was hard by Ahab's place, palace. This palace must have been the wall of the palace must have been really adjacent to Yisrael, not Samaria, or some other city in Israel where the king had a palace. When it says hard by, KJV, the word is etzel, nearby or adjoining, from the root atzal, which means to distance or to set aside. So Ahav would look out from his terrace wall in Yisrael and see Naboth's vineyard, perhaps smell the grapes when they were ready to harvest or while they were being crushed for wine. Ahab took almost literally lusted for Naboth's property. So in verse 2, Ahab asked Naboth if he would be interested in selling or swapping his property to the king. The king's ostensible reason for wanting the property would seem valid to him, but he was dealing with an honest man who was obviously one of the 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to the Baalim, which would explain Jezebel's hatred of him. Now, TSK's comment is salient as well. It says this, the request of Ahab, at first view, appears fair and honorable, but at the most evidential, he most evidentially wished Naboth to alienate it finally, in other words, to disavow his inheritance in Israel, which was expressly forbidden and provided against in the law of Elohim in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 14 to 28.
Let's pause there and talk about that, because honestly, I don't know that that's at all clear. He's being asked to sell it for silver. Arguably, if you give it to the king, you're not going to get it back. But on the other hand, we know that what the Torah says really is that at the Jubilee, the land would return anyway. And so the question is he or is he not going to honor that? And, you know, is, there are those in the comments.
That's exactly the point.
In the commentaries that actually suggest, you know, Nabote he's probably taken this a little too hard. So we're not 100% sure is all I really wanted to point out on that score. He may or may not have been able to get the thing back.
Okay. So anyway, to finish where I was at, it was high iniquity in Ahav to tempt him to do it, and to covet it showed the depravity of his soul. That's according to TSK.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The longest time that
might be a little bit extreme, in other words.
Right, and I'm getting to this now. The longest time that Ahav could purchase Nabote's land, according to Leviticus 25, verses 14 to 28, was until the next Yovel year, before the land would revert to its rightful inheritor or his family, which explains why Ahav had to wipe out Nabote's entire seed line, so there would be no valid claim on that property by anyone. And, verse 3, Nabote denied Ahab's desire with the Torah argument of the Torah scholar, King Ahav. Not having any valid argument, other than I want it, Ahav slunk back to his palace with his tail between his legs and went into a deep, sulking, and petulant funk, as we see in verse 4, where he says he's laid down and he's turned his face away from the sit. He's got his face looking at the wall, and he's laying there like a 5-year-old kid who's sick, waiting for his mama to come and take care of him. Anyway, that's what I got on verses 1 to 3 and a little touch on 4.
Okay. Well, Rob, are you buying that? Where are you at?
Well, you act like Ahav is going to honor Torah.
Well, there you go. Okay, I mean, that's the key. We know that he probably won't because we know the guy's character.
Well,
The Torah
does teach us that a king is bound to respect the property rights of families.
Yes.
And in that sense, he doesn't have eminent domain, which means that he's not a totalitarian monarchy. He's not an absolute monarchy. And that's interesting in the time period, because the Canaanite kings were absolute monarchs. They were dictatorial.
Yes.
And the land belonged to them. They were lord of the land. And you've heard me talk about this before. There's a difference between lord and king. Lord means that the land is sovereign to you. You own all the land and the people on the land. So you can do with them what you wish. And a king is just the sovereign of the government. So when you see the term lord and master or lord and king, those are two separate lines of authority. Now, in this story, you have, and the scripture bears this out, you actually have a fault of two sins. And Elijah makes mention of that when it says, you murdered him and you took his vineyard. And so for that double infraction, he receives double punishment. So it's important for us to see this. Now, then you add upon it that Nabote's sons perished with their father. So, you know, he's eradicating all inheritance to the land. And these are little nuances that most people glisten right over, and you can't do that because these are major points of the story. I know we get sucked into Jezebel's orbit, and that's all we see. But there's a major problem here. For the first time, the Hebrew monarch is declaring absolute power.
Slow down just a bit. No offense here, but he has now, to the extent that he basically caves in to Jezebel, and I know you were saying, oh, don't go overboard on Jezebel, but to the extent that he, when he goes home all like a little puppy dog, you know, didn't get his bone, he hasn't done anything yet. And all he's done basically is made an offer that was rightfully refused, simply because it's Naboth's vineyard. He can do what he wants with it. Whether he feels compelled to sell it or not, he chose not to. So that's where we are so far.
Well, what happens? Well, okay. Well, we have to go back further then.
Okay.
Because it's not that clear.
Okay. Well, we're trying to make it clear.
He comes back. He comes back. Not as Jezebel's puppet. He comes back totally despondent. He's crossed the line. Micaiahu had told the king, here is what Yahweh says. Because you have let Ben-Hadad escape, that I had given over to you to be destroyed, and you didn't do it. Now, and the term that he used, that this man that you let escape, was Ish Karmer. I was at war with him. I was at war. Yahweh was at war with Ben-Hadad. I was at war with him, and you let him go. So now the expression of strife fits with war. And
okay, so, and while you're at it, let me throw one other thing.
We're still way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, one other thing, though, before we get to that point, because Mark did read through verse 4, he came to his house dejected and upset. And then the Hebrew, that word would, and I don't have the vowel pointers here, but sar ve zaf, dejected and upset. And it's the very same terminology.
Yes.
This is where you were headed. The very same words that were used to describe how he felt after he was rebuked for letting King Ben-Hadad free. So there's the connection. It's the very same set of words that were used in the Torah to describe his reaction here.
Because it hadn't stopped.
He's still whining.
Well, it's not whining.
Well, no,
this
he's
man
still
is,
moping. Moping, I think, is the term my dad would have used.
Not
it's definitely petulance.
Yeah.
Not moping? Okay, guys.
You're part of it's,
that
it's
phrase
a, I think it's a different part of the country
that
thing as much as anything, Rob. You're over in Thailand. They probably speak a little differently over there. We call it moping in Missouri, where I grew up.
But it's not moping. It's not superficial. You guys are acting like this is superficial. This is not.
No. This goes clear to the core.
Oh,
absolutely.
King Ahab knew he had crossed a line. He knew that he went to the point of no return. That's why the Sar Yetzef, the crashing depression. And now, if anyone that's ever suffered with depression knows that if it's compounded, it's almost impossible to get out of. And that's why the scripture uses a strange term is the Nasarim Yaderi. My spirit has turned away from me is the way that it's translated, but it means he went into the depths of depression. And this is a clinical position that he's in, and now what happens with depression, people will tend to either try to buy themselves out of it. In other words, they will go on a shopping spree to lift their spirits. They'll try to drink themselves out of it, party themselves out of it, because these are feelings of manic highs. And, you know, you're trying to dig out of the hole. And so the only way that you can relieve the pain is to swing it hard the other way and to go on a high. And in this case, the purchasing of the vineyard and pouring himself into establishing a new vineyard would have alleviated the pain.
Garden, yeah.
Right. And so, well, the term there is a garden. We don't know what he's going to do with it. It's translated herbal garden, vegetable garden.
Right, right, but yeah.
It's a garden. And in the Middle East mindset of garden is more important than the Western concept of a garden. It's an orchard, enclosure where you can lose yourself. Place of solitude, a place of meditation. And so, you know, he's trying, it's next to the palace. He needs a place of solitude that he can go to. This is it. And the thing that Jezebel does, what she brings to the story is she's used to a monarch being absolute. Her father was an absolute monarch. And she's like, you're a monarch. Act like it.
Exactly. Where does this guy get out thinking acting, he can say no?
Which is not going to make him feel any better.
Yeah, stop acting so Jewish. You're an Israelite. Act like it. You know? So I want us to begin to look at it in the influences that we have here. Yes, we have the Torah, but that's a million miles away from Akav's mind right now because he is in a lot of pain. And so here he is dealing with his own demons. Here comes Jezebel. Jezebel is a fish out of water anyway. She doesn't think like an Israelite. She doesn't think like a Jew. She doesn't think like anyone that has any understanding of Torah. Torah to her, remember, just like the rest of the world, religion seasons their lives. It's not their life. Only in the Torah lifestyle does religion become your life. It governs everything from the way you eat to the way you make love. It is not just a religion for Saturday.
Okay. I'm not sure if I'm happy with the term religion there, Rob, but certainly your obedience to the Creator. I know that Scripture, at least the way I read it, often seems to distinguish between someone's religion that's worthless and what the Scripture talks about, which
yes,
is just simply, here's the Torah. It's instruction for how to live. So,
I'm using the term in the literal sense. Religion is a way of life.
Okay.
That's what religion means. And that's why, if you remember, James says that this is true religion. And so when I use the term religion, I'm using it in the clinical term. It is the way of life.
Okay. And we're just trying to be clear here as far as things that people will see in the stories. So there you go. Good. Good. It's a good distinction though.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, there you go. Do you want me to tell you what I think about the story?
Sure. We only read a few verses here, and you have a tendency to kind of go through to the end. So let's make sure we're caught up with where we are so far, because we haven't even introduced Jezebel really yet.
Okay. The signs of mercy and kindness which Yahweh had shown Ahab did not cause him to return to Yahweh. Israel, Jezebel's influence over him was as strong as ever. Adjoining Ahab's palace in Jezreel was a beautiful vineyard belonging to a man named Nevot. Okay, that brings us to what we're talking about. A while later, an incident occurred involving Nevot, the Israeli. He owned a vineyard in Israel, right next to the palace of Ahab, king of Shimron. Ahab spoke to Nevot and said, give me your vineyard so I can have it as my garden because it's close to my palace. In exchange, I'll give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I'll give you its monetary value. So he's very accommodating. But Nevot said to Ahab, Yahweh forbid that I should give you my ancestral heritage. So he doesn't just say no. He says
hell no.
In modern day vernacular would be hell no, but in this case it looks heavenward and it says Yahweh forbid that I should give you my ancestral heritage.
All right, well, forbid that we should go too much further before the break. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back.
I know someday it'll all turn around because all my life. Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joy.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition, and we're talking about a, well, at least as far as the Book of Kings is concerned, one of the more famous stories about Jezebel. Primarily, Rob would object and say it's really about Ahab, to the extent that Ahab is not acting as either king or proper husband here. But Ahab, Jezebel, and the vineyard of Naboth, and it doesn't work out so well for him. Let me throw one other thing into the mix. Now, Rob's kind of already gone in this direction. He hadn't gone exactly where I was waiting to see if he was going to go yet. He may be planning on getting there. But there are a couple of elements having to do with his dejection, his clinical depression. And I like the idea of the fact that he seems double-minded. He literally leaps back and forth. And this is one of the commentaries, like he's on two different branches. He thinks he knows what the right choice is, or at least he'd like to convince himself that he is a Torah kind of guy. On occasion, he pretends to be. We have people in the Congress that pretend they believe in putting their hand on the Bible and the Constitution and the oath they took before God. You know, so you can kind of relate to this. And yet when push comes to shove, he doesn't. He does what's expedient, or he just kind of caves in. And, it's also possible, and this was an interesting observation, that when Naboth refused to sell him the vineyard, it reminds him that he's not such a great king either, and his, in fact, entire kingdom is arguably illegitimate, because people will point out, hey, wait a minute, the kings of Ephraim or Ephraim, well, it wasn't the kingdom supposed to be through David? Wasn't that what the word says? So for all of these reasons, this guy does seem to be double-minded and unstable in all his ways, I guess, is to quote Yaakov or James. Go ahead, MP.
Okay. I'd like to move on to 4 through 7, if you don't mind. I'll go ahead and read it.
Rob, are you okay with that?
I'm going to comment on what the – what's that?
Oh, I just was going to say we'll ask Rob and make sure he thought he was done. Rob? Oh, Rob. Okay. Well, I intended to, but maybe...
Okay.
There we go.
Okay. I just want to make sure we set up the this concept of what the monarchy can and cannot do.
Okay.
The one thing, according to... I was looking at this, and there was an article called "The Socio-Juridical Background of the Naboth Incident." It's mentioned in the Journal of Biblical Literature, and it one thing that it stresses is that the Israelite Confederation was weaker. The monarchy was weaker in the Israelite Confederation because it was a confederate. It was not the same structure as the Kingdom of Judah was. The Kingdom of Judah, the monarchy, again, wasn't absolute, but he had more power because he was the head of his tribe. Ahab is not the head of the 10 tribes. He's only... being placed there as a chieftain to consult the other tribes. He's the head elder.
That's absolutely right.
In other words, he acts as a head elder. And so, but Jezebel, she comes from a Canaanite background where the monarchy is absolute. And so that's what she says to him. You know, he comes home. He's already clinically depressed. He comes home and now he crashes, which is normal. This is clinical behavior that they sleep because when they sleep, it doesn't hurt. But they don't eat. They can't eat. Food nauseates them. So clinical depression is a more severe form of depression. And so this is a disorder. It's a mental disorder. He is sick. And so Isabel saw that something had upset him and pressed him to tell her what troubled him. When Akav told her of that it was the request being refused by Nevot, she exclaimed, "Do you govern the kingdom of Israel?" You know, in other words, aren't you monarch? Aren't you the king? Eat, be happy. I'll go get Nevot's vineyard for you. So now she's throwing her weight behind this. Now, what does that matter? Twofold. Yes, she's the queen of Israel, but she's also the princess of Phoenicia. So she feels very powerful. And whatever Israel can't do, she can also command an army out of Sidon to come and do her bidding. She's not bound only to Israel. She is a rightful princess of Phoenicia. And so she can muster an army there. So Isabel was used to a monarchy having it over the land and the people, and an Israelite didn't have that. He was not a king in the sense even that Judah was, much less a sovereign as in Phoenicia's or the Canaanite fashion. So there's a cultural problem here, not just a religious problem. Isabel doesn't understand the government of Israel. She just doesn't understand it.
Exactly.
Much less the religion.
She doesn't. She's used to an absolute monarch, and that's not what the Israelite king is.
No. And so with this in mind, she's out of order, naturally. But she doesn't really care, you know. Had all of this been unchallenged, had there not been a displeasure that Yahweh had over Achav, and he was allowed to flourish naturally, he would have become a dictator. That was what he was ultimately heading to do, because of Isabel's insistence, was to form a kingdom along the Canaanite line. And I think what this story tries to do is to allow us to see the corruption of Akav, that he is leaving the Confederate mindset of a more democratic kingdom. And remember, Jeroboam was very democratic in his setting up of the religion and the government. And Akav isn't having that. He's looking towards the Canaanite way, and he sees a more comfortable way of ruler. And let's be frank, it is. The less people you have to talk to in making decisions, the easier it is to rule. And certainly this is where Akav is heading. He doesn't like having to talk to the other tribes. He doesn't like having to try to get everyone in one vein of thought. And it wasn't fun trying to battle Ben-Hadad that way. So there's a lot of issues. And I think he's tired of also listening to the prophets. You know, that they're an irritant in his ear, kind of like a mosquito that buzzes around your head and you keep swatting at it, but you can't get it. That's what the prophet seems to be to Akav. He's irritant. He's an irritant. And especially when now that Akav feels like Yahweh has left him, and we see how kings act when they feel like that Yahweh's not hearing them anymore. We saw how Shaul acted when Yahweh wouldn't talk to him. And Akav is doubly troubled by that.
Okay.
Okay.
MP, anywhere else you want to go?
You want to read verses 4 through 7 for me, Mark?
Sure. Okay. So, Ahab came into the house. We've already kind of talked about this pretty well, but we'll do it quickly. Came into his house dejected and upset. There are those two words again. Sar ve yatsaf. Over the thing that Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him, and he said, I wouldn't give you the inheritance of my fathers. So he lay down on his bed. He turned away his face, and he would not eat bread. And the only other comment, I guess, is he doesn't want to look at anyone, seems to be one of the things that shows up in the Midrash. And this is pretty well consistent with what Rob's been saying for a while here. So his wife Jezebel came to him, and she said to him, what is this that your spirit is dejected and you don't eat bread? He said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for silver, or if you want, I'll give you a vineyard in place of it. And he said to me, I won't give you my vineyard. And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, is that the way you're going to be a successful king over Israel? And Rob's already kind of put this a little bit more bluntly. Come on, what kind of king is that? Get up, eat some bread, let your heart feel good. I'll give it to you. Here he's going to, she's going to take it in the hand. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. And then, says, she wrote, now, you want to pause there, Empire? You want to go ahead to the next step?
Yeah, I want to pause there. I want to take time with what we get into next.
That's good, because I think that's a good place to pay a good place
yes.
to stop for a minute.
Yeah, we take this in bits and pieces. We can get into it and really okay. So that's what I want to do here. Okay, so verse 4 through 7, where the King James Version says that he was heavy and displeased. Both here, by the way, in 21:4, and also in chapter 20 in verse 43, the exact same words are used. The Hebrew is sar vaze'ef, okay, to rebel, sar, and to hide anger from onlookers. He was in rebellion to Yehovah because he had made the Torah mitzvot to not separate a man from his inheritance forever. That is, Yehovah had made that. You're not allowed to separate a man from his inheritance forever. It only goes until the next Yovel year. Okay, so he couldn't let himself show it to others. Achav couldn't because of his Torah scholarship, of which he was quite proud. Okay, but he was literally lusting for something that he, the king, could not have. He went into his bedchamber, laid on his side, facing away from the room, and refused any comfort. He was acting like a brat, really and truly. And Proverbs 22:15 is really salient on that. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. But who's going to correct a king with a rod? Okay? Nobody's going to beat the king with a rod, okay? Only Yehovah could, and he will do so. But it may cost Achav more than he can afford. Go ahead. Do you have something to say, Mark?
No, I was already laughing. I just was saying that's either going to get happen or somebody should. But there you go. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so Azamra has this to say, and I'm still in verse 4. It says, what could be wrong with gazing at something belonging to somebody else and merely wishing it was mine? In the words of Rambam, this is a quote of Rambam from Laws of Robbery 111. It says, the appetite for wealth brings one to desire the property of others, and this brings a person to robbery. If the owners refuse to sell their property, even after being offered much money and put under heavy pressure, if they seek to prevent the covetous person from robbing them, it can bring him to actual bloodshed. Get out and learn the story of Achav and Naboth. That's what Rambam had to say, okay? So, really interesting. Now, verses 5 through 7 has Isabel coming into his room to comfort her little boy, like Mama used to when we were sick and home from school. You remember? I mean, it's 60 years ago now. But I remember my mother comforting me when I was a little kid feeling bad and couldn't go to school, right? This is literally how I see Achav and Isabel's relationship in this particular instance. And it's like she walks in and she says, is Mama's widow boy sick and have a temp with ya? And Achav is acting like a 5-year-old. who has no control over his circumstances and needs comfort from his mommy. Now, Isabel has not even 1 ounce of motherly affection. So when he tells her about Navot's refusal to take the deal for his vineyard in verse 6, she tells him to stop feeling sorry for himself, to get up and eat. Mama's here to take care of him. And I assume that he did just that for even not even asking how she would do it. In other words, she gave him the Bayer children's aspirin, patted him on his pointy little head, and sent him off for soup and crackers while she gets rid of the problem. And that's where we're going to go, beginning in verse 7, where she gets rid of the problem, or verse 8, rather, where she gets rid of the problem. So I'm going to stop there and let you guys have it.
I got a sense that you've got something to say, Rob, on that.
Guaranteed.
Well, one thing I'd like to, okay, first and foremost, it should be stated that legislative law is, and we're talking about here Torah, is preeminent.
Yes.
For example, the Mishnah Avot, the Parke Avot, 3:2 states, Rabbi Hananiah, the deputy high priest, said, "Pray for the welfare of the ruling power, since but for the fear of it, men would swallow each other alive." And yes. So, without Torah, and when we're talking about ruling power, we're not talking about the king, we're actually talking about the court. Without it, men would eat each other alive. And we see this in the story of Navot, is that if the Torah and the land rights of the Torah are not respected, then we don't have anything.
Absolutely.
See, if the precedent is set by the king here, that he can just go and take a person's land, then when you buy a piece of land in Israel, you don't have a surety that it will not be taken from you if the government wants it. The Baba Batra puts it this way: all taxes, local taxation, and royal laws that are customarily formulated in their kingdoms, the law is that all those in the kingdom shall willingly accept the laws of the king and the statutes, and the halakha is that it is absolute law. So it changed in over the years, where the monarchy begins to have more and more power, and the court is trying to try to catch up with that, instead of being an irritant and saying, "Okay, no, the king can't do this. You can't allow the king to be a dictator."
Well, interestingly,
because what the laws?
What we're really talking about here, guys, is what the United States said in terms of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and property, that it really matters that people have some surety over what is theirs, whether we're talking about their vineyard or their very lives. And, of course, we're going to talk about Naboth's life here in a minute, too.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And, you know, the main reason that America was so great for so long is because it really held to that property rights thing. They've gotten away from it now, as far as the government's concerned.
We understood that all rights, if you think about it, are property rights. That's the essential element. If you don't have a right to own property, well, wait a minute, then you're a slave. You don't have a right to own anything, including your own body. And we've seen that throughout history.
Right.
I can take it. I can destroy it. I can kill you with impunity. The king's rule is, this is where Rob is headed, absolute. An absolute monarch literally can say off with his head and mean it.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, the Torah says, and remember the issue with the daughters, that there was no inheritance and it wasn't clear if there were no male inheritors, what happened to the land? Well, Moses said it went to the daughters. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so what do we see in that? We see in that that the owner of the land is sovereign of his land. And that's unique, especially during this time frame where the people owned their land. Well, that wasn't the way it was in the Canaanite countries around them. It's not even that way, to be honest with you folks, it's not even that way in the United States anymore.
No, it hasn't been for quite a while. There has been no true property ownership here since at least the time of the so-called Great Depression, when people realized that fee simple absolute, in other words, absolute ownership, allodial title disappeared. Now Big Brother owns it, and you pay property taxes to the feudal lord.
Right.
We've talked about this before, of course.
Right. So it's in fact, in some deeds it even makes mention of a 99-year lease. So with that having been said, for instance, if you were to be digging for a water main, and all of a sudden you break into oil, that's not yours. You don't have mineral rights of your land.
Well, there are people that still do, but they begin to separate all kinds of things in law, you know, equitable title, this kind of title, that kind of title, mineral rights, water rights, surface rights, you name it.
My point was, if you're in an incorporated city, the city owns the rights to the mineral rights, owns the water rights. You have to get an approval to dig for water. And they will come out and test your water from time to time. And it's for your own health. I understand that.
No, that's what
but
they tell you.
There is a sovereignty. and there's a sovereignty issue. Just the story that we heard just a minute ago, where you don't even have lordship of your body.
Right.
That the government can come in and declare that you will receive treatment. And you can say, well, I'm not sick. I don't care. You're going to receive treatment anyway in the form of a vaccine. Now, what does that do to the Jehovah's Witnesses' rights? Now, you can say, well, I don't care about Jehovah's Witnesses. You need to care because
you do it. Absolutely.
Today they come for the Jehovah's Witness. Tomorrow they may come for you.
Well, they are
and
coming
so,
for all of us.
Tomorrow they will come for you.
So the issue is that you don't even have lordship of your body in our government, in the American government. And so don't get too haughty at this story with Nevot and Achab, because this is just showing you the erosion of the rights of the people in the Confederation of the Ten Tribe Kingdom. This is slowly falling apart. This will ultimately come to a head when the Assyrian king carries everybody off to bondage. You say, you may have wondered, how could it have been so easy? Well, it's because it had imploded from within. Rights had been eroded, and so people don't fight for nothing. If they don't feel like they have a country, if they don't feel like they are bound to the land, and that the government is an extension of the people, then they don't fight. You either fight for king and country, or you fight for liberty and freedom. We have found over the years that fighting for liberty and freedom is enough. That king and country isn't always enough to fight for, especially if you don't like the king and if you don't feel like you're bound to the country.
That'd be all what it's cracked up to be,
Right. Yep. So this situation is
all right. Well,
this
hey,
is the sickness that we have right now.
And what we also have is a break right now, so we'll be back after this.
Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true.
I know someday the Lord turn around because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more, there'll be no more, and our children will pay.
All right, folks, welcome back now to the second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. We're talking about the story of Ahab, Jezebel, and Naboth and his vineyard and what happens to him. We've pretty well set this up and talked about a lot of the, the introduction, things people need to understand about the idea of sovereignty and whether the king of Israel at this point should or should not have certain powers that eventually are going to be claimed, certainly by other kings, having to do with property rights and a lot of stuff, and how it's all going to play. And, of course, ultimately we'll get around to what's often referred to as the spirit of Jezebel that we see in the world today. It all does seem to spring from this story. We went to break. I don't know if Rob was quite finished or not, so go ahead, Rob, if not, and then we'll go back to MP, because I know he's got some comments on these verses here.
Well, this whole issue about land rights is a murky one, I have to be honest, because the land is given conditionally and temporarily to those who merit it through their actions, not absolutely. As expressed so eloquently at the end of the Parsha Bahar in Leviticus 25:23, says, Yahweh says, I own the land. You're strangers and sojourners with me.
That's right.
And Rashi says something kind of interesting. Why did Israel lose the land? Not Judah, but Israel, I'm talking about here. Why did Israel lose their land and their freedom?
Well, he told them.
Well, he said,
I was going to say, he, meaning Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, told him it was going to happen. If they
did. Sure. But why did they lose it? In Rashi says, it's because of unkept Sabbaths, idolatry, promiscuity, bloodshed, and Shemitah. You didn't keep Shemitah.
Yep.
Now, that may sound strange, because that's dealing with the 7-year cycle. What that does is it reminds the landowner that he doesn't own the land, that he's a steward of the land of Yahweh, that his ownership of the land is governed by his merit of keeping Torah. Now, that throws a total different mixture into the story.
You know, what's interesting about that, Rob, is that Yah doesn't actually remove the land from them. He just removes them from the land.
And so, well, and this is my point. Do we need to look at Naboth? What's going on in Naboth's life that this is happening to him?
There's certainly that question. Now, I know where you're going to go because I've read the Midrash as well. Understand that there's a lot of stuff that is going to be said about Naboth's life that I don't know that we can determine from Scripture. But go ahead.
Well, I'm throwing that out there.
Oh, I thought you had a particular place you wanted to go because it's all there.
Yes, I'm wanting us to all look at that. Not just me. I want us to all look at this situation. What I'm trying to say is, what happens in Bible stories is we try to look for good versus evil, black and white, and pick sides and cheer for the underdog. In this case, Naboth. And generally, a Torah story is compounded and convoluted. It's not clear. And it's written that way on purpose so that you will uncover its truths, that you will dig deeper.
You'll dig into it, right.
Uh-huh. Now, what happens is Christians don't want to do, Western thought doesn't do that anyway. Our stories are pretty superficial. They're clear cut. There's a villain and there's a moral to the story. And it's usually a superficial one. And that goes all the way to Aesop's fables. And we like myths that are easy to understand and we don't have to really dig deep into them. And when a story is deep, then it's criticized for being too academic, too esoteric, so on and so forth. And you see that with critiques of movies that try to go into a deep vein, like The Matrix or something like that, and how they're panned by the critics because they're just not a romp-filled fest.
And they don't understand
them
anyway.
They're too deep, and you have to think, and nobody likes to think anymore. So anyway, this is
one of the reasons I like the Matrix movies, because you have to think.
Well, that goes back to the mind that is disciplined by Torah. When you begin to condition your mind in that vein, then you begin to look at everything like that, and you don't look at the superficial. You begin to look for the deeper meaning of life, and certainly that's, I think, commendable. But anyway, in this situation, let's look at Neville's life and see what can we deduce from the story. And is he pure? Is there any room for critique of his life? Why is Nevote killed? Why is his sons also killed with him? Why is a whole line obliterated?
Okay. By the way, of
the evil Jezebel.
Before we get there, let's at least talk about the story too a little bit, because what's Jezebel going to do first, Rob? Let's read through verses 11 to 14. And were you ready to go on at that point, MP, or did you have something else before we do?
Yes.
Okay, so let's read the next few verses.
I'm ready to move into verse 8. Yeah.
She, meaning Jezebel, wrote messages. She basically forged Ahab's signature. And she sealed them with his seal. She sent the messages to the elders, to the nobles that were in this city who sat with Nabote. And she wrote in the messages saying, proclaim a fast and have Nabote sit at the head of the people. Have two worthless men. It's interesting when you see the term worthless men there. In other words, have two New York Congress critters type guys sit opposite him and let them testify saying, you cursed God and the king. And then take him out and stone him and he will die. So she is setting him up to die right here and there. And that's where you want to pause, MP. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to look at verse 8 in some kind of depth. So Isabel sat down and she wrote letters to the elders and the nobles of Israel. Israel, that is the city, Jezreel. Now that word nobles is from the Hebrew 27:15, hor, white or pure by fire. From the Hebrew charar, which means to parch or to dry from extreme heat. Now, these guys were politicians. And like most politicians today, they would not know purity. They would not know purity if it punched them in the face.
Well,
they were the guys who did the hatchet work for their bosses, which seldom includes the people they supposedly serve. These were Nevote's neighbors dwelling nearby. Dwell is from the Hebrew word yeshab, of course, to settle down, to dwell in peace. Now, I assume that Nevote was perhaps he was the elder of Yisrael, Jezreel, okay, the recipients of the letter, lived in his city, Ba'iro, in his city. Okay, so these elders lived in his city, so he's the chief elder, it looks like. Nabot was the eldest son of the eldest son, going back to the original son of Menashe, who inherited the land. And he didn't get a copy of the letter from Jezebel. Okay? Had he probably would not have shown up. Azamra has this about this particular verse. It says, the Torah law of kings does permit the king to expropriate the private property of his subjects for certain purposes, according to 1 Samuel 8:14. But most rabbinic opinions hold that Ahav had no legal right to take Nabot's vineyard, which is why he had to resort to framing Nabot in order to grab it. Now, first of Ahav did not frame him.
Whoa, time out. Before you do that, made that reference there, and yes, this is discussed quite at some length, about the first Samuel, where basically Samuel the prophet warns. He says, look, come on, guys. Put this king in place. He's going to do all kinds of nasty stuff. He's going to do this. He's going to conscript your sons and daughters. He's going to take your best stuff and so forth. So don't do it.
Right.
Now, it's not necessarily. That's where I part company with those who say, oh, this is the Torah saying this is okay. No, it's not. This is the Torah warning that if you're not careful, this will happen. But it's not the same thing as saying, thus spoke Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, saying it's a good thing, just that it's the kind of thing that kings who get all upset with power might do. So I'm going to draw a big distinction there between what the prophet warned might happen, and what the Torah allows, or at least in this case, the story allows will happen. They're not the same at all.
I'm exactly on it with you. Let me read the sentence that you cut me off from.
Okay. You were headed somewhere different. It sounded like, and I want to make sure we didn't want to let that sit. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Azamra says Torah law, but 1 Samuel 8 is not Torah.
He's
and
right.
It refers
exactly
to Shemuel trying to talk Israel out of having a human king who would do those things.
Azamra is wrong. Exactly.
Okay, that's the whole point. Azamra is wrong on this particular, taking it from that position. Yeah. So they got that wrong. But that's something that comes from a very orthodox Jewish position. And you know, this is what the orthodox think. Okay, so at this point, Ahav looks to the average human. At this point, Ahav looks to the average human guiltless in the whole scheme. But was he? He was king, and his queen was writing letters in verse 9 in his name and sealing them with his signet in verse 8. So he must have known something of what was going on, or she would not have had the signet. In the letter, in verses 9 and 10, she lays out her plan to destroy Nabot's character and have him strung up like a horse thief. Shades of the politicians working in the mainstream American media. The kind of treachery that was attempted against Israel many times. Here's one in Esther chapter 3, verses 12 to 15. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, the news people. And there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants and to the governors that were over every province and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, and every people after their language in the name of the king Ahasuerus was it written and sealed with the king's ring. The king didn't write it. Haman did. Okay. Pui. Okay. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little women and children, in one day, upon the 13th of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people that they should be ready against that day. The posts went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan, the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. Okay, that's Esther 3, 12 to 15. What Isabel wrote was all lies, and the recipients of the letters all knew it. But each of them stood to gain from following the king's order. So why not? And that's where that's what I got on mostly verse 8 and a little bit of touching on verses 9 and 10. I'll I'll cover 9 and 10 in a little more depth after.
Okay, I know Rob wants to talk about more with respect to Haman, with respect to, you have me doing it, to Naboth. So go ahead, Rob.
Okay, so in this case, and again, I want to make sure that we understand that that we see in the second part of the Torah passage, Parsha Bahar, a dramatic understanding of Torah, beginning in the blessings and ending in the curses, that promises the Israelite people peace, security, and prosperity if we keep the Torah's commandments, and dispersion to exile if we fail to keep those commandments. And remember what Lord Acton, the 19th century parliamentarian, observed, that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So absolute ownership, too, in the case of the land of Israel, would seem to be self-destructive. And this is what's happening in a cov's life, and ultimately will end in the Israelites going into captivity. And I think that's an interesting interpolation here. For the authentic Absolutely. Torah position, as expressed in the laws of the sabbatical year, reminds us that those who dwell in the land do so as sojourners and strangers, not as owners. That is true of Nevot. That is true of Akav. Akav is a king, okay, but not to be so disagreeable with Mar Patron, but these men weren't cronies. These were the chieftains of the tribes. What Isabel is doing is she's trying to get a consensus. That's what you do in a confederation, is you get a consensus to rule. And she needs a consensus of the other chieftains for Akav to rule eminent domain over this land. So that's why she writes the letters. She understands that she's got to get their approval for Akav to make this move. Now, she doesn't do it in her name because, again, she's Phoenician. She's not Israelite. And so she knows that.
Are you excusing her? Are you excusing her fraud, Rob?
No, I'm not excusing. And it's not fraud. It's not fraud. This is exactly what she has to do. This is law. This is what she has to do. Now, you can say that he doesn't have the right of eminent domain. But what she's doing is she's trying to get the chieftains to give her husband the power to declare ownership over this land from Nevot. So,
well, no, she's trying to get Nevot killed first.
They're going to have to go out.
She's getting him killed under false pretenses. Yeah. There's nothing here about let's get his land. It's let's kill this dude, and then we'll tell you what's going to happen later. So I'm not sure that I'm with you on this.
Well, the only reason that we're trying to exterminate Nevot is to get his land. There is.
Do they know
there
that?
There is a. No, but the charge is that he is not observant, and so he needs to be executed. And in that case, then eminent domain can be declared. But in this case, we're just trying to say this guy's a nasty guy. He doesn't belong in the kingdom. He's a bad player. And so with that in mind, still she's trying to get a consensus from the chieftains. And that's exactly what she's supposed to do.
Okay, that's where I can't get my head around the fact that she's supposed to do something which is absolutely at variance with everything, Torah, and now I know she's a pagan, and obviously the Bible does not hold Jezebel in high regard, but I'm still just having difficulty with the whole.
Neither do I. But I'm
okay. So it's maybe it's the way you're phrasing it.
That she was a Torah scholar in her own right.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, I'm not talking about
kind of like
Torah
Hitler. He's a constitutionalist.
I'm talking about Confederate rule, and if. In Articles of Confederation, you have to get a consensus to rule. And so otherwise, he could have just taken the vote and killed him, taken a police action and just killed him. But You can't do that in the Confederation. Could do that in an absolute monarch. You sure could. Until the people rebel and rise up and throw you out or kill you. This, in this case, she understands that she's got to get a consensus of the chieftains. And that's what's why she's writing this. That's not a fraud. What fraud is trumped up charges against Nouveau. Did he deserve it? Did he deserve it? Now that's my point. Are they trumped up charges or did he deserve it? Is there any truth to the accusation against Nouveau? That's what we need to look at.
Okay, so we didn't read all the way through the story. I'm going to contend that even though we haven't read it all, I don't see it either as such. Now, I know there's a Midrashic claim that there is something that's there. I'm not sure that I would go there. But, one other thing. I'll mention this because the Midrash talks about it as well. This at least makes sense, okay? Proclaim a fast and have Nabot sit at the head of the people. So essentially, the idea is kind of like what's been done with the election fraud and so much else that we're seeing play out today. Try to get people keyed up as if somehow this crime that we're going to accuse somebody of, which is bogus anyway, is worse because of when he dared to do it. So the idea that, there's a fast going on, and while ordinarily blasphemy against the king would be bad enough, it's exceptionally bad now, people are going to be all frosted about this. So there's an element of that in here. All right, Rob, I know somehow or other I'm not quite following where you're trying to head.
Okay. Well, what does she claim that he does? He does two things. The crime that she says that Nouveau has committed is, number one, and it may be a compound, and I think it is that Nouveau has committed something that most people outside of a kingdom don't understand, and that's lis majesté, which is a French term describing the crime of violating majesty, an offense against the dignity of the reigning sovereign, or against the state, but in this case, against the sovereign. And we have that in this country. We can't say anything against the king.
Only if he's a proper socialist. You can if it's Trump. You can kill people.
You can't do it in Thailand.
Okay, that's, you guys.
Oh, you meant this country. You're talking about where you're at.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Can't talk bad about the king. They'll hang you.
It's against.
Sorry, I just wasn't sure which this country he meant for a second there. Yeah, okay.
And this is kind of interesting because the behavior was first classified as a criminal offense against the dignity of the Roman Republic of ancient Rome.
You got it. Yep.
And so, but here in this story, I think is what we have mentioned here. Because notice what it says. It says that the letter proclaim a fast and give Nabote the seat of honor among the people. Have two good-for-nothing men sit opposite him and have them accuse him publicly of cursing Elohim and the king.
Yeah.
Then take him outside and stone him to death.
KJV has sons of Belial there, Belial. Okay. Yeah. So, worthless people is the way it actually is translated, but that's the way that they put it.
They like it. Right. They like that terminology.
And so.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I don't mean to be ugly, but the sons of Belial is comparable to sons of bitches in English.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're having, it's a derogatory term.
These are not nice guys.
No.
All right. Well, it's time for the break, so we'll leave it there, and we'll talk about the not nice guys in a minute. Because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joke.
All right. Well, I got to ask. I think we interrupted Rob, but I'm not sure there. So, Rob, why don't we go and let you pick it up anyway, because the music came up, and I don't think you finished this. Or was it? Okay, go ahead, MP.
It's okay.
Are you disagreeing with me? It was you? Okay.
No, it was Rob that was on.
Okay, well, then.
I'm just saying the crime of lese majesty can be prosecuted as treason. That's why the punishment of being stoned to death is mentioned in this passage. And these laws are still applied as well in monarchies outside of Europe and the Middle East, such as in modern Thailand and Cambodia. So this is not unheard of. It may be in the West, but it's not unheard of. And understand, Thailand is not an absolute monarchy. It's a democratic monarchy. And so this is all about the respect of the monarchy, the king. And in this case, even though it's a confederation, what Jezebel is arguing here is that an affront to the reigning sovereign is also an affront to the state, to the confederation, and so is treason. And that's what she's petitioning here. And she's trying to get a consensus of the chieftains to allow them to execute Nivo. We can talk about who's going to get his land after that's handled. But right now, we're just trying to get that done.
Right. Kill him first. We'll worry about. It's kind of like what Trump said about the firearms, right? We'll worry about due process later. Just take away their stuff first.
I don't know. What are you talking about? I don't know what he said.
The big deal here nowadays is there's one piece of property that the Constitution says shall not be infringed. And the basically the leftists, and unfortunately, that seems to include the White House at this point, and some rhinos are all saying, well, see, if we declare someone to be not up to snuff, and we'll decide what that means, then we'll go take their guns, because maybe they know what the Constitution says. Maybe they're a threat because they know that the point of firearms is to prevent that. They're called red flags law, or ERPOs, and so forth. So they're literally doing this, Rob. And the line from Trump was, take the guns first, worry about due process later. And some of us said, is this the guy that we thought was supposed to be a, you know, somebody who actually could be trusted to honor his oath? And it really is. It's probably the biggest single concern I've heard yet out of the Trumpian mouth.
Yeah, that would be a problem. Now, according to a Torah, and certainly the custom of the Israelites, a fast day was a signal for self-searching and for correction of any sin or evil in a private or public life. And Jezebel is perverting that, you know, for her own ends. So she's incorporating an air of religion to this crime against the state and against the sovereign.
Well, I think she knows Torah, and she twists it all the time.
If you believe that Hiram was a righteous man, that's
right.
the Phoenician king that helped build the temple.
Right, and I believe he was.
Then you would think that Torah then is esteemed in Phoenicia.
Absolutely.
Since the days of the incorporation of Dan in...
Just like it's esteemed by Ahab, although he misapplies it so often.
Well, yes, and understand, it was esteemed by our founders.
Absolutely.
You know, now, they may have bought into the Christian lie of replacement theology or whatever, but it does play an integral part in the formation of the United States.
Absolutely. The whole government is based on the Sinai Covenant. The whole Constitution is based on the Sinai Covenant.
Well, it's an amalgamation. Let's be honest. It's an amalgamation of Greco-Roman thought and Judeo-Christian thought.
Absolutely.
It's really a hybrid of all of those, which is what the Renaissance period was doing, was melting Greco-Roman thought and Judeo-Christian thought together.
Exactly.
Okay, with one exception.
That's what made it so good.
It is true that Deuteronomy by far was the most quoted book during the entire time period. When it came to law, they literally went to the book of Devarim.
Yeah.
Well, because Leviticus deals with priestly law, and Deuteronomy deals with civil law. And so naturally it would be. And two, because the Messiah quoted from Deuteronomy and Isaiah for that matter, more than any other books.
Absolutely.
So the Christian is comfortable with Deuteronomy. And so that's why you see them, you see it more quoted. But anyway, in this case, we see the accusation is, and so do you think Nabote can be accused of not respecting the king?
He can certainly be accused of it. It's whether or not it was true that we have no idea from the script, from the story.
My point would be then the way that he handled the king earlier, does it show a disrespect of the sovereign? I don't believe he cursed Elohim, but did he disrespect the king? That's the point. Did he disrespect the king? I can tell you, I'll be honest with you. If the king had asked for something in Thailand, the people would have been over backwards to give the king what he wanted because they loved the king. And Nabote does not love Ahab. You can see that.
Right.
Okay.
I don't think he even respected him. If he had, because Ahab gave him what he offered was a very good deal. I just want this. It's near the palace. I'll give you something better. You know, I'm not asking for an equal trade. He said, I'll give you something better. And the Nabote said, no, not no, but Yahweh forbid that I should do this thing.
Okay,
that could be construed as blasphemy.
Okay, now there's a problem here, Rob, and I hear where you're going, and by the way, there's some other places to go, because the bigger question, and this is where I thought you were really headed, is did Nabote deserve to die because he'd somehow done something anti-Torah and torqued off the king of the universe? Not Ahab, I could care less about that. But did he deserve to die because he somehow did something anti-Torah? And on that, I contend that Scripture seems to be silent. And the same thing is true because we've already addressed this issue of, does he know that the land will or will not revert to his family? And by the way, there's a claim that these guys are at least cousins, obviously, because they have neighboring parcels. So they're clearly at least a few generations back some kind of relatives. But, you know, we have not even addressed, and the Scripture seems to be silent on the question of whether or not this is a complete sale that would violate Torah, or, you know, it's yours up until the next Jubilee, and then he gets it back. And I don't know that we can answer some of the questions you're asking without that.
Well, that's my point, is I understand what the Mishnah says, and certainly, but I'm going by the text. what does the text say? What issue did he violate? We can say that when he evoked the sacred name in his refusal to give the king what he wanted, could be construed as blasphemy. And this is something that's again, strange in the Western mindset, where they just throw around deities' names all day long. But in this case, you don't just throw around the name of Yahweh any way you want to.
Are you really claiming, Rob, I'm still confused here, that this is essentially the argument that Jezebel is making? It seems to me that there's no claim. Now, Mark may or may not be right. She's clearly a clever woman, a devious woman. But, how well, I don't believe she obeys Torah. I don't put it past her to use it.
If it
suits her purposes. So having said all of that, it's still not clear to me that she isn't just making this up out of whole cloth, and that we don't have any reason to think that he has actually truly committed blasphemy, even if he said the words that, he did say the words that Torah says. So that's where I still have some difficulty, not parting company with where I think you're going.
Well, I'm trying to stay with the text.
I know. And I keep thinking, well, there's texts we just don't have here in terms of being able to stay with it, at least where it seems that you want to go.
Yeah.
Well,
the fact is that he does use the sacred name.
Yes.
And therefore, according to tradition, that could be seen as blasphemy. Although, Yehovah uses his name all the time.
And it's not clear to me that that's not a very modern thing, to say that Achtung is verboten to say the name.
Well, I'm not saying that you're not verboten to say the name, but you're verboten for, I hate to use the German words with Torah, but anyway, we're forbidden to throw around the sacred name willy-nilly. Yes. And this was not a good reason to evoke the sacred name, to slap the king in the face.
I don't think that he was trying to slap the king in the face. I think he was trying to say, I can't do that.
Because
Yah told me I can't.
No, I think it was an affront to the king face to face. Hell no, I'm not giving you my land. What's the matter with you? Get out
okay.
of here.
Okay. Well,
this was a sovereignty issue. And this citizen is telling the king, you've overstepped your boundaries. Back off, big boy. This is my land.
And I believe he's absolutely correct.
He is correct.
And I don't think that he said it in that tone of voice either.
Well, I think so.
He was talking to the king. This guy could probably have his head whacked off.
I don't think that he thought that. Understand, he doesn't have that authority. Ahab doesn't have that authority to lop off his head any time he wants to. He's a confederation. He's not an absolute monarch.
It ended up being for all practical purposes.
Well, yeah. Later on, and this is my point, is that he keeps crossing these boundaries that's alien to Israelite thought.
Wait a second. Who are you saying? You're saying that poor Nabote is the guy that's doing all this. And here's where I'm having the difficulty, Rob. It sure seems like we're making the boat out to be the bad guy here, and I have a trouble with that.
I'm not trying to make the boat the bad guy, but I'm trying for you to see what the argument is.
I see the argument. I don't buy it, is all I'm saying.
Okay, you don't have to buy it. I'm not saying that. I'm saying is he did disrespect the king. He didn't give the king what he wanted, and But this is not an absolute monarch. And so the Israelite doesn't view the king the way that kings are viewed.
That's right.
In neighboring countries.
Especially one who was Torah observant. And remember, this guy, at least I think, this guy was one of the 7,000. He was after Jehovah's heart.
I'm not sure, Israelite. I'm not sure if Rob would go there. Right. Do you?
And that's why I'm thinking that this is why he struck back the king in such harsh terms by evoking the sacred name. He's telling the king, you've crossed a boundary here. You're not allowed to do that. And, you know, he's saying Yahweh forbid. In other words, it's forbidden by Torah for you to be doing this. It's forbidden from Torah for you to ask me this. And what Jezebel sees
Polish scholars should have known that.
And what Jezebel sees is you can't throw around the name of a god like this. In her country, you couldn't do that. You couldn't just throw Dagon around or Malkart around. You had, you know, that there were penalties of using sacred names. And so here she evokes two things. The sovereignty issue, the laissé majesté, and blasphemy of a sacred name, of a deity. And so she has grounds. Is it lawful grounds? That's the point. She's asking the Confederation to declare these two things treason. Now there we go. Here's where it all stems. She's saying that Nevot is now an enemy of the state.
Yes, I can agree with that. That's exactly what she's doing. Read what the text says. She said, "Find two men, sons of Belial,
worthless creatures,
okay? Set two men before him to bear false witness against him. Thou didst blaspheme God and the king." Okay? First of all, you can't blaspheme the king. Okay? You can only blaspheme God. So she's convoluting all of this stuff, but she's making it look like it's via Torah observance. Okay? And she's giving the politicians in town that cover.
Right.
Okay.
Well, again, you're talking about politicians. These are chieftains of tribes. These are elders. These are judges.
They're the elders of the town.
And the Sanhedrin. These are judges that live outside of the town.
These are politicians. I'm with Mark. City council.
These are politicians, they're worthless men among them, and they're willing to buy into a lie, and they've seen a letter up front that's telling them, we're going to frame this guy and kill him, and they're going along with it. They're politicians, Rob, on this score.
You're trying to put the sons of Belial and these elders as the same person. They're not.
I'm saying they're willing to accept the word of sons of Belial, kind of like when I see idiot Congress critters believed Clapper or Brennan or Hitlery. They know darn well that these people are lying, and they don't want to see it. And that's where I have a problem with this whole story.
The reason why the chieftains are in Jezreel are not because they live there. It's because that's where the palace is, and so they're there to do business for the government. You're right. But they're not politicians in today's fashion. These are chieftains of the tribes and supposed to be scholars of the Torah. And we can argue that point. But my point, listen to what Rambam says. The appetite for wealth brings one to desire the property of others. And this brings a person to robbery. If the owners refuse to sell their property even after being offered such money and put under heavy pressure, if they seek to prevent the covetous person from robbing them, it can bring him to actual bloodshed. Go out and learn from the story of Achav and Nevot. That's in the Laws of Robbery 111. I think this is dramatic. This is a dramatic story anyways, isn't it? But Achav... allowed, you know, he first covets in his heart the land of Nouveau. I guess that's the truth. We don't get that from the story, but that's what's been implied in the story over the years, that he coveted the land. He certainly wanted it. It was convenient. But I think the real issue here is not the land so much as his sovereignty. I think he felt affronted. I think he felt insulted. And certainly Jezebel did. And a woman does not like to see her man being disrespected. There's a weird thing that there, because a woman's love is based on respect. A man's love is based on appearance. So it's important that we understand the dynamics here. Nevot actually played into the hands through no fault of his own, because I don't think he realized what was going on. He just knew that he didn't want to give up his land.
Okay, let me do this, Rob. We've only got about 2 minutes left in the show, and actually we haven't even read to the part of the story that I think everybody knows we're heading up to, which is they're going to take him out and kill him. But you know, so in the last 30 seconds, see if you can't summarize exactly the where you are headed here as far as you know, on the scale of things. I can't help but think we've talked more about poor Nouveau. Well, I even put that in there. Nabote's failings more than we have the evil that's being done to the guy. And I almost feel like, if I don't at least mention that before the top of the hour, I've done a disservice here. Because he does get the short end of the stick, well, no doubt about it.
Yes, and the only reason that we're dealing with this is because the story is so well known. And Nabote's position is so well known, but Akav's is not, because we've over the years we have chosen sides. And I'm just saying, slow down, caution, let's approach this with a level head, let's look at and see what's being done here. We do see that there are quite a few commandments being dealt with here. There is the sin of covetousness, contrary to the 10th commandment. We see bearing false witness, which is contrary to the 9th commandment. We see blasphemy being talked about here, which is contrary to the 1st commandment.
If these were true, for sure, yeah.
Well, we know that the sacred name is bantered about here in a common way. That's troublesome. So then, and then on top of that, we have murder, contrary to the 6th commandment.
Okay.
So, and wait a minute. And then we have a stolen vineyard, contrary to the 8th commandment.
And moving up, you could argue about all kinds of other things. He's moving boundary lines too, if you're taking something that doesn't belong to you. So, okay, less than 30 seconds, MP. Okay, we literally out of time. Anything else, Mark? And then we'll obviously have to pick it up next week with a story that I figured we'd have been finished by now. But there's a lot here, obviously, and there's clearly a lot of disagreement as well. Take us out, Mark. MP?
You gotta turn on your microphone.
Alright. I think by the time he turns on his microphone, we're gonna have the music up. So what I'll do is just to say, hey guys, lots to talk about, and we will pick it up here next week. So thanks for being with us, folks. Thanks, guys. Shalom.